Good morning. I'm Gary Gramling, Chairman of the Housing Commission, and happy Friday the 13th. You know, in some countries, the 13th is not an unlucky number. And actually, when I was in Japan years ago, I noticed that 4 was the unlucky number, and the fourth floor didn't exist on the elevator button. So. Choose your own day to be lucky or unlucky. But on a rainy day like this, please be careful. Okay, so do not look at that clock for some reason. I'm told that it's on Hawaiian time, but I don't understand that because it's not moving. That's it. It's Hawaiian time. It's not moving. Okay. What we know is this clock will be correct twice a day on that. So, but at this moment, it's 9:03 a.m. According to my clock. All right, so a couple of administrative items. Members of the public who wish to address the Housing Commission must complete a speaker request form. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes each. The public comment non-agenda item speaker request form looks like this. And you can get one back there. And if you hurry, you can fill it out and get it over to Angie in the corner and still make it for the public comment section. For those who wish to speak on agenda items, we have speaker request forms, pink and gold. Nothing is implied by the color. Our color selection is just tradition. It was here when I got here. So speakers are limited to 3 minutes each. I think I said that. Collective testimony by those who support or oppose an item shall be limited to no more than 15 minutes total per side. Non-agenda public comments are heard at the beginning of each meeting. And members of the public also may request to have an item pulled from the consent agenda once the consent agenda is proposed. To speak on a matter on the agenda, you complete that speaker request form and again get it over to Angie. Hearing that, we'll go to our agenda. And now we'll ask for non-agenda public comment. Martha? And as you know, you need to press a little button over there so that the red light comes on. And Martha, I have a question for you. You have 2 request forms, one for non-agenda, one for an agenda. Just to ease everything, would you like to speak on both of them at the same time?
I'll separate them, that's okay.
That's fine. But rather than having you speak, sit down, get back up, come back, we'll do it that way.
Is it on? Martha Welch, is it on? I want to speak of HUD. Now, I know the HUD for 2014-2015, 125 and 14 and 16, 15, 116 million. I'm going to get a HUD. I'm talking to HUD about an audit to you guys. I don't know where it went. I can't no HUD in this county. That's what we need for the HUD. We need that. It's 30% or 60 of that. Now, in Credo, that's what Section 8, that's what you say, everybody. Now, look at this building over there. It's San Diego. It says everyone in there is Section 8 property based over there. I don't believe that. Now, if you go to the form, Section 8, it says San Diego, properties of Section, that's all you can do in San Diego. That's not right. I don't think you, the owner should, doesn't get money from the county, I don't think either. Now, this is, now when I call, there's no rent. When you go to apartments, there's no rent on the 70s. They don't tell you how much rent. You have to, the questions all the time. When I talk about St. Paul Village, they don't, I don't know what's the rent. Well, let me talk to you. I went to Iowa's senior, it's just building. You know, they told me 5 years. They haven't even filled it up yet from this 5-year wait. I'm not on the list, you see, because they hate. I'm not on the list. That's why. They have lists to get in on this stuff, you know. It's not right what you do right now. Now, I used to do Potiphar. They have 3 rents there. It doesn't matter what your rent is. They just decide if you're right, if they like you or not. And in property-based Section 8, if the manager likes you, you get that. That's how it works in this county. It's not right what they do about this. And HUD should know about this. And right now, the federal government should come back because they've left us and we have to have this audit. What happened to the money? Because that's a lot of money. I saw your financials and I know how much money you have in there. And that's strange for reserve because you have a lot of money. And
Your 3 minutes are up on that.
I had 2 minutes for the other one, but it's really short.
Okay.
I don't like 24 hours notice. I think the Brown rule is very clear. 70 hours before you change the time. That's maybe you should have training with Brown rules because you don't have this on television. You know, that's Brown rule says you do all this stuff, and I hope you follow the Brown rules.
Thank you. That last comment was addressing item 100 on our agenda, so that you'll know. And we generally don't comment on the public non-agenda items. I will tell you, though, Martha, that HUD does do periodic audits of the Housing Commission. And I'm told that their auditors were out here from cold climates like Green Bay and Chicago during the Christmas holidays. So I'm sure that it had nothing to do with the weather differences on that. But it does happen. Thank you. Commissioner comments. Commissioners, do you have any comments today?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Okay. Mr. President?
Thank you, sir. As always, I've got a handful of comments just as to report on items that have happened since the last board meeting and to announce a couple of events coming up. On December the 20th, there was a press conference held by the mayor dealing with the 1,000 Homeless Veterans Initiative, the Housing Our Heroes program. And the mayor, as you know, referenced that program in his remarks last night. Just for the record, to make sure people understand that 10 months into this program, where we had targeted 1,000 vets to be signed up to receive a voucher and other housing assistance, vets who are homeless, we have some 762 who have either been housed or issued a voucher and are out looking. So that program is proceeding apace, and I'd like just to recognize Melissa Peterman, heads up our homeless outreach efforts, and also who works under Jeff Davis's direction, the fine work that we're doing in that program. It is proceeding pretty much as scheduled, and we're very pleased and proud of it, and I was very pleased that the mayor addressed it last night in his remarks. Also of note, and this was a nice biggie, on December the 7th, the Wells Fargo Foundation awarded the Housing Commission a $100,000 grant also to support the 1,000 Homeless Veterans Initiative, the Housing Our Heroes program. You see a photo there with the mayor and Jeff Davis who are accepting the big check. And this grant from Wells Fargo will provide temporary stays in hotels and motels for homeless veterans' families looking for longer-term housing. It provides assistance to purchase furniture and other transitional assistance and provides some career training assistance. So we're very pleased with this, and those of you who know Wendell over at Wells Fargo, please thank him for us. This was a nice one. And for a bank to make that kind of award to a public agency is rare. So this was a good one. I'll also point out that on December the 5th, we participated in a press conference with the mayor and also the then city attorney to kick off the city attorney's SMART pilot program. And SMART stands for San Diego's Misdemeanors At-Risk Track. And what it is, we have set aside 10 beds in temporary housing for homeless folks who would risk criminal prosecution for behavior but will be offered more positive assistance and beds to sleep in lieu of going to jail. This we see as the beginning of a long-term relationship with the city attorney's office and a program that I think is going to grow as we go forward. Not part of the Housing Commission, but kind of related since your CEO is chairman of another board, and that is the Regional Continuum of Care Council on the Homeless. The RCCC, or the RC3, voted last August to merge with the Regional Task Force on the Homeless. Now, the RC3 administers some $16, $17 million in federal homeless monies that come into San Diego every year, oversees that, and provides advice going forward on how that money should be used. The Regional Task Force on the Homeless does the annual count, which is to occur here next week. Those two agencies merging, I think, will provide a good bit of streamlining and efficiency from the two organizations. And since I became chair, I'm very pleased and proud of this, what's going to happen. And we expect to have that taken as a vote at the RC3's monthly board meeting next month. And, Mr. Chairman, two other announcements of events coming up next week. One is on Wednesday, January the 25th, the Housing Commission will conduct the 11th annual Project Homeless Connect in downtown San Diego. This is a fair for homeless folks, providing advice, assistance, support activities. This fair will take place from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Golden Hall in the San Diego Concourse on the 25th. And the one-day fair will provide services such as health screenings, flu shots, dental exams, haircuts, legal aid counseling, housing counseling, pet care, and other assorted services. This is the seventh of the 11 years that the Housing Commission has been the lead organizer. Our main partners are the City of San Diego, the Interfaith Shelter Network, Family Health Centers of San Diego, and Father Joe's Villages. I would ask you all and also the public listening in to visit our website. If you know of individuals who would like to donate or donate items or volunteer, we could use new or gently used clothing, shoes, blankets, new or gently used backpacks. And we would welcome anyone who would like to show up there to provide volunteer activities. Also next week, just coincidentally, in the wee hours of Friday, January the 27th, at that point it will be the Regional Task Force of the Homeless will have merged with, and this is week after next, come to think of it, thank you, it's 2 weeks from now. The Regional Task Force on the Homeless and the Continuum of Care will have merged by that time. And the point in time count will be conducted from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. on Friday, January the 27th. I know that there are a number of the commissioners, just might be all of you, who have volunteered to be with us that day. And we are responsible for completing the point in time count, which is required by HUD as a matter of receiving those funds I mentioned a while ago. Again, this is a lot of homelessness stuff that we're talking about. I couldn't be more pleased with the way this agency has risen to that challenge over the past 2 or 3 years. And I look forward to our programs in assisting the homeless to grow in coming years. And, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my report.
Thank you. And once again, just double-checking on commissioner comments. No? Okay. We'll move forward. Next item is the adoption of the consent agenda, and I'm proposing that items 100, 101, 102, 103, and 104 be moved to the consent agenda.
So moved.
Okay. It's been moved by Commissioner Tassin and seconded by, I'm not sure, both Commissioners Surdy and Davis, that we adopt the consent agenda as proposed. Any discussion? Seeing no indication of such, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. The consent agenda is approved. Item 50 is the approval of the minutes of the December 2nd, 2016 special meeting that was held in lieu of the regularly scheduled November meeting. You all had a chance to receive and review the minutes. Are there any changes? Seeing no indication of such, is there a motion to approve? Commissioner Surdy has moved to approve the minutes as published. Is there a second?
Second.
Commissioner Hubbard has seconded that motion. Any discussion? No indication of such, so I'll call the question. All in favor of approving the minutes as published, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed? That's carried unanimously. All right, so then now we move to item 105.
Good morning, Chair Gramling, Mr. Gentry, Commissioners. I'm Debbie Ruain, Executive Vice President with the San Diego Housing Commission, and with me is Mr. Charles Christensen of Christensen and Spath, here to present the request for single-room occupancy hotel determination at 701 East San Ysidro Boulevard, also known as Gateway Inn. I'll be introducing the request and then deferring heavily to Mr. Christensen, as this action has involved significant legal research and his expertise. The request before you now is the staff recommendation to approve the determination that Gateway Inn is not a single-room occupancy hotel and therefore is not subject to SRO hotel regulations as cited in San Diego Municipal Code Chapter 14, Article 3, Division 5. And, in view of the unique circumstances relating to Gateway Inn, the Housing Commission Board is requested to make an exception to authorize payment of relocation benefits to each of the low-income residents at the property in an amount to which they would have been entitled had Gateway Inn been determined to be an SRO. Key facts and historical events are that the Gateway Inn is a 34-unit hotel originally constructed as a travel lodge motel in 1956 for use as a motel. The units range in size from 215 to 265 square feet. There are no kitchen facilities in any of the units except the manager's unit. The current owner is Trilin LB LLC, which acquired the Gateway Inn in September 2012. In June 2014, the City of San Diego issued a notice of violation to the owner for operating the hotel rooms as individual long-term rental units, with the office and manager's apartment above the hotel office being rented as a single-family dwelling. Unpermitted uses of the pay parking lot being utilized as a drop-off pickup location for shuttle business and food sales, that the hotel pool had been removed without the required demolition permit, and that modifications had been made to the original hotel without the required permits, inspections, and approvals. In August 2016, all residents received a 60-day termination notice from the owner, at which time the Housing Commission was made aware of the situation and that the property was potentially an SRO. The property had been erroneously on a Housing Commission list, an SRO list, so staff and general counsel began research to determine indeed whether or not Gateway Inn was an SRO and if it was subject to the SRO regulations in the city's municipal code. If it were, this would authorize relocation and reimbursement payments to the residents. In November 2016, the city's code enforcement division issued a notice and order to vacate and repair or demolish the building because the property was in substandard condition and a public nuisance, and that all rooms be vacated immediately. The owner served 60-day notices to vacate the occupants. However, approximately 18 units are still occupied, despite the unsafe and unsanitary conditions of the property. The owner intends to demolish Gateway Inn and build a parking lot in its place once the property is vacant. After extensive research at the staff level and with general counsel, including a review of architectural floor plans, historical resource board reports, records from the State of California Department of Parks and Recreation, rent rolls, building permits, and zoning ordinance history, the Housing Commission staff and general counsel have determined that Gateway Inn is not an SRO, never was an SRO, and was incorrectly placed on the Housing Commission's SRO list. Despite the fact that our determination is that Gateway Inn is not an SRO and therefore not subject to relocation or reimbursement benefits, Staff requests that the Housing Commission Board offer compensation to the 18 occupants as if it were an SRO. This would be done to lessen the inconvenience caused to the tenants by displacement, and the Housing Commission can do this under Health and Safety Code Section 34320.5. This is a unique circumstance and would be a one-time accommodation, which would not establish a precedent for any other property in the future. I'd like to acknowledge some guests in the audience. We have Mr. Bob Vaki, Director of the Development Services Department of the City. And with him is Mr. Michael Richmond, Deputy Director of Development Services Code Enforcement Department. And Mr. Frank Lynn is also in the audience. And we're here to answer any questions you may have. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Christensen, as I mentioned, to ensure the matter is thoroughly read into the minutes and that all legal issues have been covered.
Thank you, Debbie. The issue of regulating SRO hotels is governed at the state level by Government Code Section 760. 7060, excuse me. That section was passed by the legislature back in the 80s and generally prohibits public agencies from restricting an owner of real estate that has rental property from going out of business. There were court decisions concerning this, and in that regard, there were cities that tried to preclude certain owners from going out of business, and litigation ensued. And as a result of this, in 2003, the law was changed to allow any city inhabitants greater than 1 million to be able to actually regulate SRO hotels, provided that the permit for the SRO hotel was granted on or before January 1st, 1990, and provided that the owner did not request before January 1st, 2004 to be relieved of those obligations. The city amended its ordinance in 2004 to replicate and incorporate the state law. In that regard, it provided that SRO hotels could be regulated on the replacement and relocation basis as long as the criteria set forth in state law was met. In just doing the math, the only three cities that had inhabitants of more than a million at that time were San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. So that then has some play in connection with this matter. The staff, in coordination with the DSD, and by the way, we've had an excellent working relationship with DSD in this matter. They've been very, very helpful in helping us come to the conclusion that we've come to. As a result of looking at the records, we've made a determination based in part upon the report from DSD, the notice of violation that was dated June 2nd, 2014, which provided and states in part the specific elements in violation include, but may not be limited to, the following. Hotel rooms are being used as individual long-term rental units and business offices. That's critical. The fact is, from the date of original construction in 1956 to the current date, an SRO hotel may not be sited or used on this property. Originally, Travelodge built it and occupied it and operated it through 1996. Thereafter, it was sold to Ramada Inn, and it was operated up through and including 2012, where the Lynn entity, the current owner, acquired title. It's clear that from the inception through the time the Lynn entity acquired title, this property was never occupied as an SRO hotel. That's important because the ordinance, the city ordinance, is documented in section 143.0510 at SEC, which regulates SRO hotels. This has never been an SRO hotel, And our determination in that regard is supported by determinations made by Development Services as well, both in their June 2014 notice of violation, and then subsequently DSD issued an order to demolish or vacate in November 9th of 2016, this year, based upon the fact that it was being occupied on a long-term basis in violation of law, in part. In addition, there are other health and safety code matters. People are living in the property in conditions that are not safe, decent, or sanitary. As you well know, the Housing Commission is charged with helping low-income tenants and providing and making sure that those tenants live in safe, decent, sanitary housing. Under the provisions of Health and Safety Code Section 34320.5, the Commission, although it has no legal obligation to do so, has the ability to grant relocation benefits in instances where it feels that it's appropriate. It's the staff's recommendation in this case that the tenants are the people that are being harmed by this action. They're living in substandard conditions, virtually a slum. The site is infested. There's trash everywhere. There's been modifications to the property, electrical work done without permit, and these tenants have currently been given a 60-day notice to vacate. There's current litigation ongoing where legal aid is representing the tenants in connection with the notice to vacate. There's been an unlawful detainer action filed. And so we're at a point where at some point in time the owner has been ordered, and by the way, there's a criminal action pending too in connection with this matter, in order to get enforcement. So we have two branches of government doing the jobs they're supposed to do, and in this case, we, the DSD and the Housing Commission, have gotten together and decided that we needed to coordinate our activities, and so and we fully support what DSD is doing. It's within their purview, and they're required to do that. In that regard, we suggest that although there is no mandate to provide the relocation assistance, that there are between 16 and 18 families or units that exist that could benefit from this relocation assistance. And we're recommending that the relocation assistance that would have been provided if this had been determined to be an SRO hotel under the terms of the ordinance be provided to these tenants, notwithstanding the fact they're probably not legally entitled to it. We do that as a very unique and special action. We're recommending it on a one-time basis only. This is not to set a precedent. It's because of the many unique issues that I've just raised for this board that the recommendation is being made. And so this decision, your decision today, will be subject to review by the Housing Authority if they choose to review it. If they do not choose to review it 7 days after your action today, this action will become final. That concludes the issues that I wanted to talk about, and if you have questions on a legal basis, I'm here to answer those questions.
Mr. Tassin, before I recognize you for purposes of that, I just want to do an additional clarification. In spite of the decrepit condition of the property, and I've driven onto the property since this matter came up, and in spite of that, our actions and our authority is limited to only the question of, is this an SRO? And whether, and if it is not, then of course we would remove it from our role. And then the second question is, would we make a one-time exception to accepted policy and allow for a relocation allowance to be paid out of our funds to these people who would otherwise have received one had it been an SRO? So purely that's the limitation of our question. Is that true?
That's correct. Those are the only issues that are relevant today before this board.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Atassa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Christensen, for detailing that out very clearly. A couple questions that I have. And first of all, let me just start by saying that I agree 100% that it's not an SRO. There's no debating that issue. Staff's brought it out. I'm sure DSD's opined in the same fashion. So that's not an issue for me at all. But I do have some questions. When Mr. Lim purchased the property from Ramada in 2012, it was still being used as a motel, I suspect.
That's correct.
The city of San Diego was still receiving TOT.
They should have been, and I assume they were. I don't know that as a fact.
Well, and maybe Mr. Vaki can respond to it. When did the city determine? Sure.
Push the button and make the light come on. Please identify yourselves.
My name is Franklin on behalf of Tri-Lynn LB. I purchased the property in September of 2012. When I purchased the property was vacant. The building was vacant. It was only being operated for the parking.
Okay. So it was vacant at the time. So this, and when you purchased that property and you began to operate it as a business, what was the first type of business that you operated there?
Well, when I purchased the property was being used as surface parking. So I continued the surface parking for a period. And I can't remember when I started renting the property for the long-term rentals and then some of the units as offices.
Did you ever operate it as a motel?
As for transient overnight guests? No, I did not.
So you never paid the City of San Diego transit occupancy tax based on your operation?
No, because I operated as long-term rentals.
Was your business venture as a surface parking a legal use?
Yes, it was. Okay. And that was the existing use when I purchased the property from a local attorney, King Namnapur. His family owned the property for many, many years prior to me purchasing the property.
Mr. Lynn, have you benefited from operating this operation, this commercial venture, as a long-term rental of tenants? Have you benefited financially from that, or has your group benefited financially from that?
Yes and no. I've received rent for the property, but also since the notice of the 60-day tenancy termination, and even before that, I know when I gave the notice, nobody has been paying me rent or reimbursement for any utilities since August 2016, and some tenants before have not been paying me rent.
But prior to that, you benefited. Before the City of San Diego gave you the notice of a violation on June 2nd, 2014, you were benefiting financially from your operation, right?
Yes, I was.
And you knew that it wasn't an SRO?
I didn't have any reason to think it was an SRO. As a real estate investor, an SRO has a shared bathroom, shared kitchenette. When I purchased the property, we did a title search. There was no indication anywhere that it was an SRO. I didn't have any notice that it was an SRO, nor did I have any indication as to think it would be an SRO. I'm in the hotel business, and as an investor, I look at different deals, and some deals are pitched to me that are SROs that have a shared bathroom. So I would have no reason to think it was an SRO.
And yet you decided to operate it as an SRO.
I operated as an extended stay. In the hotel business, a lot of times when occupancy is not where you want to be, you operate it as extended stay. I've paid taxes on all the income I've received. I have never not declared any kind of taxes. with all the income I've received. I've made repairs to the building during, in order to, at the time, to rent it out to these individual, to these individuals.
But you knew that it wasn't permitted to be an extended stay?
I did not. At the time I did it, I did not know that the city was going to issue me a violation until they issued me a violation.
Whether you knew or you didn't, you benefited financially from operating as an extended stay, right?
I benefited financially, and the tenants benefited by staying there. Yes, I did. And yes, they did.
Do you have any responsibility in taking care of the tenants, the 18 of the 35 or so that are still there, on making sure that they're relocated, since you appears that you care about having provided housing, extended housing for folks?
Well, Mr. Commissioner, the average rent that was being paid was $600 a month. They stopped paying me since August. That's 6 months ago. 600 times 6 is $3,600. So I would think that that is a adequate consideration for relocation. I'm also having to be out of pocket my attorney's fees by having to file unlawful detainers because they will not move out. I've given them, I erred on the side of safety. Instead of giving them 30-day notices, I erred and gave them 60-day notices. They stopped paying me rent, and we're going through the legal process. It is now mid-January, right? What, 5-6 months later? And so I'm out of pocket every month for attorney's fees. I'm out of pocket for utilities, and they're living rent-free.
You're a businessman, right, Mr. Lynn?
Yes, sir.
You're in the real estate business?
I am.
You understand about when you acquire properties that you do due diligence on what's allowed on a property? You probably have seen that before on other properties, right?
And I've done it, sir, myself, yes. Yeah. That's what I did when there was no indication that this was an SRO. I looked at the laws for an extended stay. I mistakenly thought it could be an extended stay. The building department disagreed with me, and
that was a mistake that you made, is what I'm hearing you say, that in thinking that you could operate it as an extended stay, right?
Yes, sir, and I'm dealing with the building department and city attorney's office with that.
And that's a responsibility that you've assumed, right, because you made that mistake. You acknowledge that you made that mistake.
Yes.
Do you have any responsibility in taking care of the relocation costs for the remaining tenants that are there?
I don't believe I do, because they've been living there rent-free for 6 months now. So 6 times 600 is $3,600. I think that is an adequate relocation for them to pay. I also had to pay $3,000 to the Housing Commission in order to go through this process, as Mr. Christensen said, and this should have never been on the SRO list. The zoning for this property says in footnote, it's zone SYIO-CSR-3, which allows for hotel motel use. Footnote 5, it specifically says that SRO is not a permitted use. And so, in extensive dialogue with the Housing Commissioner and Mr. Christensen, I tried to convey that this is the position of the building department. This is what the zoning says. And so I am out a lot of money, too, for this being on the SRO list. When it shouldn't have been.
When you're in business, Mr. Lynn, you acknowledge that there are times when business deals can cause you to lose money, correct?
Absolutely.
That's the line of business that you're in. You understand that one as a real estate owner or developer, that there could be pitfalls and one could lose financially on a deal, right?
Absolutely.
And that's what's occurred here. You are now losing money based upon your misunderstanding of what was allowed here and how the remaining tenants that are there are behaving and not paying rent, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have no further questions. Mr. Lynn, here's my problem with this. My problem is that setting aside the emotional side of making sure that we want to take care of the folks that are there, I'm not sure that this is the responsibility of the Housing Commission. I appreciate Mr. Christensen's point of saying we don't want to set a precedent on this, but I'm very familiar with how situations like this occur, and these set precedents. And I don't want the Housing Commission to be rewarding bad behavior here. And this, I think that this is the responsibility of Mr. Lynn. The fact that, you know, he's got tenants there that aren't paying rent, that's his problem. Okay? He needs to resolve this issue. And he needs to step up to the plate to handle these relocation costs, not the Housing Commission. Has there been any discussions, Mr. Wayne, on any type of arrangement to share in that responsibility? Or are we just thinking, let's try to resolve this issue and let the Housing Commission handle it?
So there have been, there's a, back to the little bit of the history, there's a criminal action pending, and the resolution of that criminal action is within the sole purview of the city attorney's office. We have had discussions with DSD as to whether or not, in connection with a potential plea bargain, that relocation assistance might have been negotiated. We have a reason to suspect that it has not been. And so that's one issue. But and also to the, and I don't know if I've answered your question. So because of that, staff had thought maybe that would be a good thing to do, is to request that some relocation be done. It is not legally required,
right.
And so we get into this area that's a little bit dicey. With respect to, I'd be interested in knowing, unlawful detainer, having practiced law since 1973, I've done a couple of unlawful detainer actions, and my great displeasure of having to do that. But normally, when you do a 60-day notice to quit and somebody hasn't moved out, you ask for the rent that hasn't been paid. I'd be interested in hearing from Mr. Lynn as to whether or not they're asking for that rent or not, or whether he's just going to on a vacation. I'd be surprised if that's the case. And I suspect that if and when this judgment is granted, the judgment will include repayment of that rent for that period of time to Mr. Lynn's entity. And the other thing is the every title company in San Diego County has the list of SROs. And so in doing your due diligence, it would have been very easy to determine that, in fact, this was on the SRO list. And you could, before you buy the property, as a reasonable and prudent real estate investor, you would have done that due diligence and dealt with that issue at that time. And as a condition of buying the property, you would have gotten that cleared up through the Housing Commission and or DSD. So I find it a little disingenuous to suggest that a real estate developer that is experienced in this area would have missed something like that and then gone ahead and did the extended stay. One of the things you do check is the specific plan and the zoning, and Mr. Lynn just indicated that there was an express exception to operating as an SRO nonetheless, and extended stay. Nonetheless, he did that. So a little bit troubling.
Well, it goes to my point that this is the responsibility I don't think falls to the commission to cover this. I understand that we're in a situation right now, and maybe there has to be some sort of a bridge arrangement, but that really has to be taken into consideration when this whole criminal action gets resolved and the fines are assessed. It may be premature for us to be considering this at this point. I certainly am not in support of the Housing Commission picking up those relocation costs and rewarding bad behavior.
Question. When did this property actually get onto the SRO list?
Yeah, so the SRO ordinance originally...
Not when the ordinance.
Well, this, I need to explain, okay, because it's more through the through the years, and depending upon when you were is when the list occurred. So originally, in about 84, the SRO ordinance came into existence, and I think in the second amendment of that, there was a determination or a duty imposed upon the commission and the city to jointly survey properties and to determine whether or not they were eligible to be on this SRO list. And as a result of that joint operation, this list was created. So sometime in 84 or thereafter.
You're saying that this property was put onto the SRO list while it was being operated by Ramada Inn or Travel Lodge at that time as a motel?
I'm saying that in fact it was on the list as a result of joint actions by the city of San Diego and the then Housing Commission.
Mr. Chairman,
as to Mr. Christensen's comments and perhaps questions, number one, I am not going to seek back rent in these unlawful detainer actions. Number two is that I have submitted the title reports to the commission as part of the package, and in the title reports there are no indication that this property is an SRO. Number three is as to Commissioner Ertesen's comment about delaying this process until a discussion with the city attorney's office can be had into a possible fine for relocation. As an attorney myself in Nevada, I understand that that your authority and your jurisdiction, everything is code-based. And the first item we're here is to determine whether this is an SRO or not, and based on the well-written and well-researched and well-documented report of the staff, they're recommending to the SRO commission, the board, excuse me, that this is not an SRO. And so I don't understand how there's a legal basis to, one, compel me to pay a relocation cost and in fact, make the approval of the staff's request that this be removed from the SRO requirements, but yet require me to fulfill one of the requirements of it being an SRO, the relocation costs. Secondly, as I've mentioned, I urge the board here to consider that these individuals have been living here rent-free for months, for going on 6 months now, and that if there were a relocation costs, as I read the statute, if my memory serves me correct, and I haven't read it recently, because this request wasn't in the report, and the request that I pay for the relocation wasn't in the report. I believe is it 2 months rent? What figure are we talking? So I can, in the spirit of cooperation, so I can at least consider it, even though I don't think there's a legal basis to compel me, because once, if the property is not an SRO, then the board, the commission has no more jurisdiction over it. Is that correct? If it's not an SRO. And so how can the Housing Commission compel me to pay the relocation costs to individuals that are living rent-free when it no longer has jurisdiction over the matter?
Did you allow these people to enter residency with a written agreement?
No.
It was just oral agreement month to month?
That's correct.
But it was understood to be month to month?
Yes, it was. And that's why I gave a 60-day notice as opposed to a 30-day. I only need to give a 30-day notice if people live there less than a year. Some people live there less than a year. So I just erred on the side of a 60-day notice back in August of 2016, August 17th of 2016.
Okay. and maybe you've got the answer, maybe the city representative's got the answer. On the extended stay ordinance, what does that require in terms of length of tenancy and documentation?
Extended stay is defined as 30 days or more.
30 days or more. Okay. Thank you.
And so just so I can consider, what is the relocation cost?
Jeff?
Yeah, the code provides relocation costs are equal to the average of the 12 months before the action is taken of the rent, two times that amount, plus $10 for each month that the inhabitant has lived in the property in excess of 90 days, subject to a limitation of $210. So, in effect, if they lived in it for 2 years, they'd get the $210 plus two times the average rent for the past 12 months.
So approximately $1,410.
If that's correct. We have information showing that some were as high as almost $800. We've got a rent roll that was supplied by Mr. Lynn. So the staff report said that at or below $2,000 per unit is what we suggested the cost would be. If in fact it is, the people there are at $600 a month, then the amount would be at most $1,410.
Times
18
units.
Yes.
No.
It's actually down to, I believe,
14
units.
Well, the issue is where do you start?
There's actually a modification I'm going to suggest if we go to that point, because the number may actually exceed 18 units, because some people may be shown to have actually left because of the 60-day notice, which by some form of implied intimidation or whatever. So the actual number may end up increasing to the extent that people could show that they were, if we wanted to increase at all, if we wanted to make it, the number could be potentially 25.
Times two?
Times what, $1,410. Mm-hmm.
So the issue here really is the precedent. Yeah.
Well,
is that right? Yes.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. And Commissioner Bertasson's correct. I mean, that's the reason we made the record here today, is in an effort to show the unique circumstances. But I've been doing land use for many years, and as Mr. Artasin has said, once you take an action, everybody will point to the action, and so it could create a precedent.
We were also contacted by the city. The council member and Mr. Gentry had some discussions, and I'd like you to share those.
Well, also, I was going to recognize him because he's indicated he wanted to make a comment as well. So why don't you address both items there?
Mr. Chairman, there are basically two related actions before the board this morning. One is pretty simple. Is this or is this not an SRO? It's pretty clear that it is not. And so we need your determination to that effect in order for then if there is concurrence at City Hall, that proper disposition of this property can take place. And that's pretty simple and straightforward. The complications are the relocation numbers, and that's on before you for one simple reason, and that was the judgment of your CEO, that this was the way to bridge two difficult situations. We have a situation where this is clearly not an SRO, but it was classified as an SRO for years, for decades, improperly. And we have a certain number of families who are in some financial difficulty, or frankly, they would not have been living in this kind of a property in the first place. Not fit for habitation. So for those families, you can expect not to have many resources. I think, frankly, and I recommend to you that the de minimis relocation benefits be allowed out of our money, since legally I've been advised that we cannot enforce the landlord to make those payments, whether he should morally or not. We don't have the legal basis to require it. Now, if we make this payment, and if there is a precedent here, what I would submit, with all of my legal training, would be that it would be one The chairman's holding up a zero for those listening. The precedent would be if there ever in the future happens to be a property that was improperly classified as an SRO, where families could have reasonably expected to be covered with SRO benefits and it was not, then that might be a precedent. I'd be hard-pressed to see any other precedent. Now, anything could be alleged, but we've got one of the best attorneys in town sitting before you who can deal with that. So I'm looking at this from a human standpoint, from those families down there who are in need and who could reasonably have expected this to be covered under SRO guidance had they been advised of that by anybody who searched the records. So this is a square peg in a round hole. There is no absolute justification to do this. This is a way to bridge a difficult situation to help families in need. I think the precedent setting here is minimal, and that issue of relocation is before you simply because I made a judgment that this would be a reasonable thing to do given the exigencies of this particular situation.
Commissioner Moraga?
I just have one quick question before we make our decision. Do we know if the residents are seeking relocation payments in their legal actions?
I have not seen the complaint, but that brings up another point. I would be interested in seeing the complaint to see whether or not the money is being sought. That's where you ask for that. When you do your notice to quit, will say you're to get out, and in addition, you're to pay the money. And then when you file the unlawful detainer, that request for money is also there. It's very easy for, as a matter of fact, I can call Mr. Mason at our office and we can get a copy of that pleading while we're proceeding here to see whether it is or not. Or maybe Mr. Lynn would like to give us a copy of one of those complaints.
Mr. Christensen, all those complaints have been dismissed because of, so I had to re-serve the 60-day notice because the Legal Aid Society had determined that the original 60-day notice in August lacked a personal property provision, so it was defective. So I reserved the notices in December. As you know, Mr. Christensen, also for what Mr. Commissioner Moraga was asking was, were the tenants seeking relocation benefits in unlawful detainer actions? From my understanding of San Diego unlawful detainer actions, a tenant cannot countersue because it's an expedited process for any monetary damages. They have to go to small claims court. And so when I refile for these unlawful detainer actions, it was my intent not to seek any kind of background, because I just would like the building vacated. And I have also communicated as part of the 60-day notice with the tenants living there that if you vacate, even though you haven't been paying me rent since August, I'm not going to go after you for any back rent. Some individuals have taken that offer. Some have chosen to not take that offer and still reside there rent-free and utility-free.
It's been a while since I participated in an unlawful detainer action, but I believe that the tenants have the right to withhold payment of rent if the property is uninhabitable, and they can do it under a claim of uninhabitability, which might later be resolved against them, in which case they'd have to bring that forward. So I don't have a great sense of loss on your behalf regarding the lost rents, because that property has been determined by code enforcement to be uninhabitable and to be in extremely poor condition. I personally have visited that property. I have not been inside a unit, but I'm, as a contractor and as a certified inspector by multiple organizations, I can tell you from the surface that property is uninhabitable. And quite frankly, I think one of the things that we feel here regarding you and that property is that if you do proceed to demolition of that motel, you're going to end up benefiting for being a reprehensible slumlord. And And that bothers us, quite frankly. I don't know. I don't know if I have a lot more to say on that at this moment, but I do have another question. You mentioned that you paid your taxes all these years. You've reported the income both from the parking and from the rentals over these years. Have you paid the taxes to the city treasurer as operating a rental? There are rental taxes owed by landlords, and are those paid in full?
I'm not aware that they are. If they aren't, I'll take it up with the city treasury. But as far as I know, in discussion with my accounting firm, everything that I owe to the city and to the state and to the federal government have been paid in full.
Well, but you don't know about that one.
I don't know either way.
Okay. So I don't have a whole lot of authority with the city treasurer, but possibly the real estate and building departments do, and code enforcement. It'd be nice if that was checked and made sure that that bill was paid in full before this matter gets finally resolved on it. Commissioner Tassin, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lynn, you have an interest in making sure that property is vacated, right?
That's my intent as Sandag, as you, I'm sure you're well aware, wants to build an intermodal center down there.
No, I know, but I'm asking you, given the legal action that's being brought before you for your notices of violations, you have an interest in having that property vacated. Is that right?
What do you mean financially? I own the property.
You own the you want people out of there, don't you?
Well,
they're not paying you rent.
If I could go to answer your question, if you want a little bit of background, I mean,
it's just a yes or no.
But it's not a simple yes or no. So if I may answer your question, I mean, I've been slinging through the mud here, called it reprehensible landlord here. I think I deserve a moment to defend myself against these.
You're going to have a chance to defend yourself, though, when you get to court, aren't you?
When I get to court for what?
I mean, there's criminal charges that are going to be brought before you, are there not?
There are criminal charges.
So you're going to have your day in court.
Okay, yes. I'm trying to answer your question, Commissioner. If I may answer your question, a little bit of background regarding this.
Sure, proceed.
Is that when I purchased the building in September of 2012, it was in much, 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 much worse shape than it is now. And so I renovated the rooms, and there's a market for below market rents. I didn't do any kind of advertising for this property. And people would come and ask, hey, can we get a room for that? Well, we're not renting the rooms out. And so we came up with a price point of $600, which we determined was below market rent for the area. And it's not really applicable, but in the law there's something called assumption of the risk. And so you're Mr. Chair, you're labeling me as this reprehensible, quote-unquote, slumlord. But
just based on looking at the property.
Okay, I understand. But when I went in there, I renovated the showers, and at Home Depot they have these modular units, right, as a contractor. You put in new showers. So I redid the bathrooms, I redid the floorings, repainted the wall, made it an acceptable place to live for these individuals that wanted to live there. Nobody put a gun to these people's head. They wanted to live there. And I wanted to operate this as an extended stay. I wanted to rent out all the units and have a little business as an extended stay. And unfortunately, the building department disagreed with me. And so I tried to convince the building department to let me. In addition to that notice of violation, they came out a couple other times, and there was a broken water heater, and there was this and with that, and the windows, unbeknownst to me, to replace a window, you have to have a building permit, right, to replace the window. So I replaced the window, but I didn't get a permit. So I hired an architect to draw plans to get everything permitted so I could have my business as extended stays. And I went back and forth with the building department, and the code enforcement part, which is separate from the permits part, they signed off on my building plans. But the permit department would not sign off on it. So after going back and forth and unable to convince the building department or the city's attorney's office that this was allowed as an extended stay, and knowing Sandag's long-term plan to make this area, my lot, the Jack in the Box, and the lot behind me, the parking area for the intermodal center, I decided, okay, I'm not going to fight City Hall. I'm going to concede that I can't have long-term rentals, even though I personally disagreed with them. And so that's when I filed my building demolition permit and going through a process of historical, and then the Housing Commission 8 months later came and said, this could be an SRO. So I respectfully disagree with the characterization that I am a reprehensible slumlord. I provided a product to the community that individuals sought after. We had a waiting list of people that wanted to live there for $600 a month. Now, I understand that most people, probably everybody in this room, you couldn't pay them to live there. But it was a product at a price point that made it affordable. And we had, like I said, we had a waiting list for people. Because I didn't renovate the whole thing at once. I renovate one room at a time, take a few weeks to do, and then it would open up. And then we'd fill it and open up and open up and open up. And we always had a waiting list. So I feel the ire of Commissioner Urdison and Chair Grambling against me that I'm this reprehensible slumlord. But if you could consider my perspective, I renovated the rooms to the point where I thought they were habitable, to the point where these tenants thought they were habitable, and gave them an alternative for their housing for $600 a month to live in an area that is right next to the border. And so to answer your question, do I have an interest in seeing this building demolished? Of course, I'm the owner. Well, yes. When you want, I have to.
You want, right. So but do you acknowledge, my question to you was, do you acknowledge that you want the tenants that are still there to leave?
I do, because one, I
right.
have to.
That's the but, answer.
No, but the answer's not that simple, because my original intent was to operate it as an extended stay, right? And I spent a lot of money to get it to a certain level to operate it as an extended stay. But after the back and forth with the building department, I decided, okay, I'm going to throw my white flag. Okay, they're not seeing it my way. They disagree with me, with my interpretation of the law. So I need to remove this product, unfortunately, from the rental place. And I did everything on the side of safety. I gave them 60-day notice in August. Well, Terry Lewin of the Legal Aid Committee found legal technicality. So now I had to redo the 60-day notices, and I served everybody in December, December 9th. So now that's February 9th, 10th, or whatever, right? And based on my experience, they're not going to vacate. So now, because they're probably just going to drag things out as long as possible to live rent-free. Now, is it worth $600 a month? Well, they can say that. Well, in hindsight, it got November 9th, the substandard condition. You can't get anything for it. But you know what? Before this whole thing started, my 60-day notice in August, people were happily paying me rent to live there because of the location, because of the product that they had in the marketplace, and because of the alternative I was providing them. But I'm not allowed to do that by the building department.
Okay. If I may, maybe I was a little tough on the use of the word slumlord, but so I'll apologize for the use of the word slumlord. But I am going to suggest that you have owned and operated that facility and remodeled it, probably in reckless disregard of the health and safety of the inhabitants. That building was constructed in 1956. What we know is that virtually every building that was constructed in the United States up until 1979 had lead paint and asbestos in it. I'm going to suggest that, oh, and by the way, you don't necessarily need a permit to replace windows if you don't invade the actual integrity of the framing structure. You can buy replacement inserts that can be done, and generally that's not requiring a permit. But if you tore open any of those walls or any of those ceilings without applying EPA's rules and regarding remediation of lead paint, then A, you violated federal code, you violated city ordinances, and you probably, had you have been caught doing it, would have been subject to very substantial fines. I've heard of as much as $30,000 per unit as a city fine. And I don't have to guess as to whether or not you followed those rules and regulations. Same thing with asbestos. And if you do get a demolition permit eventually to tear this down, it is my hope that the city and the building department and the environmental departments will keep a close watch to make sure that those EPA rules are followed vigorously on that, because we don't need to have lead paint and asbestos being broadcast throughout the neighborhood there, potentially poisoning thousands based on the traffic in that area. Well, Commissioner Tassin, did you have a...
Mr. Chairman, I've heard enough. But honestly, I mean, it's pretty clear to me. The determination that it's not an SRO is transparently clear. I agree with staff 100%. The responsibility for this, for what's gone on here, is Mr. Lins and Mr. Lins alone. I feel for the people that are still there, but he brought this on. He's responsible for it. The fact that he's not received rent for the last 6 months is not the Housing Commission's problem. It's his problem. He has an incentive to vacate that property. And as a businessman, he can negotiate with those tenants to get them out. I've done it. I own rentals. I know what that's like. I've bought rentals where there's unsavory characters in there, and I personally negotiated with him to get him out. It was in my interest to do that. And it's in his interest to do that. And it's his responsibility. So I do not support the Housing Commission paying the relocation fees.
Okay. Commissioner Davis?
I'm curious, why isn't it cost effective, especially in the long run, for you to go ahead and relocate those people that are there and clear up this issue with them?
Commissioner Davis, that's a great question that I struggle with, is that I am a word is bond type of individual, despite what I've been labeled here today. And to me, at a principle, it is not right for people to take advantage of this situation. In my opinion, they're living there rent-free, utility-free. So, with all due respect to Commissioner Erdison about how he handled his business, they have... If I never gave them the 60-day notice, if the building department would allow me to operate my extended stays, then everybody would be honky-dory paying me rent and going forward. To me, they're taking advantage of the situation by understanding that the unlawful detainer action will take time, by engaging an attorney that they don't have to pay for, the legal aid, where our tax dollars are paying for this, these attorneys to fight me. And so I would rather go through the unlawful detainer process and vacate them, because I just don't, personally, in my, I don't think it's right to me. How could somebody live there rent-free, utility-free? And I respectfully disagree with Commissioner Ertis on that, saying that that is irrelevant. To me, that is relevant. Somebody's living, I don't get to live rent-free, utility-free. Most people I know don't get to live rent-free, utility-free. Why do these people get to live rent-free, utility-free? Why do these people get to have relocation expenses? I gave them the requisite 60-day notice.
May I interrupt you? You're repeating yourself quite vigorously. But being a man of your word, a man who considers his word his bond, I find it interesting that you don't consider your implied covenant to those tenants to provide habitable quarters. That is implied in every rental agreement in the state, and yet you have clearly not cared too much for that, even though you've told us about all of the rehab work that you did at one point or another. The code enforcement has basically declared that property to be uninhabitable. The building department has declared that property to be uninhabitable. That's a breach of your covenant to provide habitable quarters in exchange for the rental agreement and the compliance with it. So your word is suspect here.
I understand, in your view it is, but to me, I provided a product. I renovated.
You provided a substandard product.
I don't believe it was substandard
okay.
at the time.
All right.
And
I'm going to cut you off. Okay, so go ahead and turn off your microphone at this point. Well, we have two items. Let's consider them individually.
It's not an SRO.
So the first question for the board to consider is this property an SRO? So that's the question. Is there a motion?
So moved. I've already made it.
Okay. Is there a second? Commissioner Moraga has seconded the motion that this property be determined to be not an SRO. Any additional discussion? Seeing no indication of such, I'll call that question. All in favor of determining that this property is not an SRO, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. It is determined by the board to not be an SRO and should be removed from our roster for that. Okay. Now we have a second item, and that's been brought to us by staff, and that has to do with whether or not we authorize the payment of a relocation expense for those who would fall within the designations as indicated by council.
My recommendation is against staff's recommendation. I do not support us paying the relocation fees.
Okay. Any other comments? Commissioner Cerdy?
Obviously can't afford to spend a lot of money. So what happens to them if they can't afford to move forward into another location? What, you know, pardon my ignorance, but I just don't understand how this can be resolved.
There's no ignorance in raising that issue. Commissioner Spoon?
Maybe it's the characterization of it as relocation costs. Would you have brought this forward if it was a gift? If it was a gift to 18 people?
No, there's a constitutional provision that prohibits that. But the exception is if there's a code provision that allows it, and there are multiple ones that would allow it here. There's a Health and Safety Code Section 34.320.5. There is Government Code Section 7060, which specifically allows public agencies to grant a relocation assistance for low-income tenants. So the answer to your question is no, if it was a gift, but the determination has been made that this would not be a gift for those two reasons.
Mr. Gentry?
Again, this the relocation issue is here simply because it was my judgment that this was a way to bridge a difficult situation that did not have a good answer and to meet some specific human needs. If this board prefers not to set the precedent, it will not hurt my feelings. I mean, I would ask you, that's okay. If, however, you feel that, like I did, that the risk is so minimal that helping these 14 or 16 or 18 families, however many there are, was worth the small dollars that Mr. Christensen said before was okay, then I would recommend you vote for it. Either way, this was a matter of judgment. I don't see it as a make-or-break issue in any way you look at it. So I would ask you just to make your judgment, and staff and I will abide by whatever you decide.
Commissioner Casson?
Mr. Chairman, this isn't about the dollars. We have the money to do this. This is a matter of principle. That's what this is. This is about being responsible with people's money on something that is of Mr. Lynn's doing. He's responsible for this. I feel for the people that are caught in the middle. But I don't think the Housing Commission should incur that expense. That's not our responsibility here.
Commissioner Davis?
In this type of an instance, I don't really quite understand. If the people continue not to move out, what happens to them legally if he will not relocate them?
He has to complete an unlawful detainer procedure.
Yeah, so the process is as follows. You file a complaint. The tenants file an answer to the complaint, or they move to strike it. It's then set for trial. The trial is had. There's a determination that either the landlord's entitled to remove them or not. A judgment is entered authorizing the removal, and after the judgment is entered, a writ of possession is issued by the court, which is then given to the sheriff, who then goes and serves it upon the tenant. And the tenant then has a certain period of time to move out, and if they don't, the sheriff will come and lock them out.
But this, again, is another lengthy period. I just don't understand why the landlord doesn't pay to get them out of there and help them.
Absolutely.
That's just my comment.
It's in his interest to not have to go through that lengthy process. He could remedy that.
Counselor, question. During that unlawful detainer hearing,
yes,
can the tenants then bring forth as an affirmative defense the city's determination that the properties are uninhabitable?
Yes. The city's determination is a public record, and so that information would come into evidence. And you're completely right. There's an implied covenant of habitability of rental property that exists in California. And Debbie was going to read the list of horribles that have been determined by the city on November the 9th, 2016. By the way, the notice and order was to vacate and repair or demolish. So the choice to demolish hasn't been made by the city. The city's given the applicant the ability to go in and fix these and then occupy them as habitable space.
Okay. Just as part of this overall entanglement, the San Diego City Historical Review Board has recently determined that this property is a historical landmark, has historical significance. When that happens, when you're given the alternative, Mr. Lynn, I'm just asking the council a question. When you're given that opportunity of repair or demolish, and the opportunity to demolish is greatly encumbered, whether or not it may end up being granted, I'm still trying to get to the idea of eviction versus repair on it. Can you shed some light?
Yeah, well, ultimately, I think it becomes a business decision as to how long you want to mess around with this, because there are appeals that are available, too, after a judgment comes in. You can, by the way, file a cross action with special relief, so those tenants could be doing that as well. This could go on forever. Not literally, but, I mean, if it ends up becoming an issue that one of the courts of appeal wants to look at, it takes a long time. As to the historical issue, Maria Burke Leah was the lawyer that represented the applicant with the Historical Review Board. She's a very good lawyer. This is her specialty. Commissions used her, by the way, on other matters, including the Churchill. While it's been determined to have historical significance, in many cases, the fact that there's a public nuisance that's been declared there will outweigh that and allow the demolition of the asset.
But the public nuisance has to be virtually irreparable?
There's a balancing test that's done as to the cost to fix it versus the benefit of the historical asset. And so, yes, that comes into play. It's very, very complicated.
Okay. Commissioner Moraga has seconded the motion. Before we call the question, may I ask a question? One more of counsel, and that is, or Ms. Ruane. So if we were to approve the payment of the relocation fee as proposed by staff, wouldn't we actually potentially be benefiting the current owner by shortening his exposure to affirmative defenses by the tenants and others, other interested parties in the community?
Great question. I do want to answer.
No, if we did help pay and facilitate the exodus of the residents, yes, that would be to the owner's benefit.
Okay, thank you. All right, it has been moved and seconded that we not approve the payment of the relocation fee. I'll give the others one last opportunity if they have any further question or statement. If not, I will call the question. Seeing no indication of desire to continue this discussion, I'll call the question. All in favor of not allowing the payment of the relocation fee, please indicate by saying aye. Opposed? Okay, the relocation fee has been unanimously determined not to be paid. Thank you. Item 106. Oh, yes. Yeah, you don't need to. Just staff, please indicate or please understand that what we need, obviously, is a complete and thorough review of our SRO list and make sure that any properties that are inappropriately on that list are jettisoned. Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
We have a much lighter topic to present to you today. Hopefully it'll change the mood a bit. Well, good morning, Chairman Gramling, Commissioners, Mr. Gentry, and Council. I'm Azucena Valladolid, Senior Vice President of Rental Assistance and Workforce Development. With me today is Stephanie Murphy, Vice President of Workforce and Economic Development. We have an informational presentation to share with you today about the continued success and unique programs at the Achievement Academy. The Achievement Academy continues to be at the forefront among housing authorities for its innovation and unique programming. With support from our board, we have developed unprecedented programs, enabling us to increase the economic independence of the families we serve through creative strategies. Our innovation has led to great success and recognition as trailblazers among the housing authority industry, partners, and new funders. As a result of our new unique programming and successful outcomes, we have been awarded new grant funding typically uncommon and challenging for PHAs to obtain and continue to develop cutting-edge programming. Stephanie and I are very proud of the work that's being accomplished at the Achievement Academy. And today she's going to be providing an update on the latest successes of the core services we provide, along with information on the new dynamic programs we've recently created.
Good morning. I am struggling with a cold, so I will do my best to not cough during this presentation. Probably most beneficial to Asusena next to me. So I just want to remind you, the Achievement Academy, it's downstairs on the first floor, and we have our state-of-the-art learning and resource center. We have a computer lab for individuals with over 30 computers for them to use. We provide three core areas of service: employment placement, career improvement or advancement, personal finance education and coaching, and also access to income supports. Some of the services that we've been providing have been workforce development services. These are workshops, resume writing, interviewing, how to find a job. We also focus on soft skills. Some of the individuals that we work with have been long-term unemployed or have never actually held a job before. This is a really key component for employers, so we explain and have workshops on how to keep a job, how to show up on time, the importance of showing up on time, how to deal with an employer that is telling you something to do and you don't want somebody to tell you what to do. So this has been a really beneficial workshop for us. Financial literacy, increasing your credit score, budgeting. There's a photo on the side there of our Money Matters workshop. We do a cafe-style workshop for our financial education where individuals can talk with each other and give ideas of how to handle financial issues, and that's been really beneficial. Recruitments, we have employers that come on site and do interviewing. Recently, we've made a really good connection with Motel 6. They have entry-level positions that they offer there, and it's minimum wage entry-level positions to get in there. It's great for our families. They also promote typically within 6 months to management. If you are a rock star worker, you could become a manager. So go from making minimum wage all the way to making $40,000 to $50,000 a year in 6 months is really an excellent opportunity for our families. And then access to education. The FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid, we have workshops that are coming up this next month so we can help the families fill out the FAFSA form so they can attend school. And we also provide access to training providers. So I want to give an overview of all of our numbers before I go into some specific programs that we've been working on. So we have continually increased the number of people we've been working with and have also increased our outcomes. So you can see we've had an increase, the increase in earnings, the individuals continually make more and more money. Our average wage is at this time right now, it's $12.36 an hour. And that's well above what we have for the minimum wage here in San Diego. And we also have people understanding the importance of their credit score and increasing their credit score. So there are a few new programs that we really want to spotlight. The first one is our multi-generational program called Strategies for the Future. And we were doing a youth program, and then we also were doing adult programming, and we wanted to put those two together and try out this new premise that they have in the funding world called multi-generational programming. Instead of doing separate programs, you do programs together. So that's why we created the Strategies for the Future for youth aged 18 to 24 and their parents. We have a single parent program for parents and their children. And then because of our programming and what we're doing and how innovative we are, we were able to receive funding from W.K. Kellogg Foundation. There's only one other housing authority in the entire country that has received funding, and they received $35,000 for 5 years. So we were really lucky to get a large sum of money from Kellogg and a three-year program, and I'll talk to you also more in depth on that. So first, our strategies for the future multi-generational program, we are enrolling the young adults and their parents Currently, we have 62 people enrolled in the program. There's two focuses. Either you can go into education or you can go into employment. As you can see by the numbers, we have more individuals interested in employment than we do education. And you can also see that we don't have very many parents enrolled. We learned from this program that as you get older, you're less likely to want to be paired with your child, or actually it was the parents that were less likely to be paired with the child, and the youth were really interested in the program. So we're learning and tweaking as we go, and we've enrolled youth even if their parents were not interested. So far we've had 25 placed in education and employment to date. We've had great partnerships with BioCom, International Rescue Committee, and Pathways, which is a GED program. This is where they've been placed. Gives you guys a good overview. So we have UPS, again, Motel 6 has been great. Grid Alternative, we have a biotech company. We've had somebody that was placed at a biotech company. Abiotech, I don't know if I'm saying that right. TJ Maxx. Education, we've had individuals going on to junior college, also to the New School of Architecture, and individuals getting their GED. One thing we've also focused on for this program was leveraging funds. We wanted to make sure that we were leveraging as much funds as we could. We were able to leverage $15,000 from the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, WIOA, and that was for our youth. They provided 160 hours of internship, and that internship was paid internship, work readiness certificate, and interview clothes. Our single parent program is where we have the parents and their children that come to the workshops. We have 55 individuals enrolled. We've had 23 workshops for the families. 19 so far have been placed in education or employment. Here's some of the locations that they've been placed. Mac Project, Pro Flowers, the Free Ride Fred, if anybody's ridden Fred down here in downtown San Diego, one of our clients is working there. And education, you'll see that this is really great for us to see that parents are valuing education, going on to community colleges, and that really helps the children as well because they're seeing their parents studying while they're studying. So because of our programming and what we've done, we designed the 2GIN San Diego program, and Kellogg funded us. They gave us $780,000. For 3 years to provide services to 60 families. So it's a very small number of people, and we're going to track them for a very long period of time. And they all are living in City Heights. That was their requirement from Kellogg, and the children had to be between the ages of 0 and 8 years old. There's four areas of focus, and these areas of focus have to be for the children and the parent. So we track for both. Workforce, so the parents going to work. Education, we also, every semester or whenever the kids have their grades, they are required to bring us the grades, and we track and make sure that the kids are on track. Social capital, that is known as best as volunteering. They have to give back to their community. The kids are required to do this as well as the parents. Financial literacy. And health and wellness. They have to attend doctor's appointments, and we've got some partnerships that I'll also share with you. So we assist them for 3 years. We track all services provided. There are 35 outcomes that we have to track, some monthly, some quarterly, some every 6 months, some annually. And we are alongside with Loma Linda University, and they are a third-party evaluator to make sure that we're doing everything we're supposed to be doing. And our major partners have been YMCA, La Maestra, San Diego Workforce Partnership. They actually gave us a free space to work out of for three years, which is remarkable. Self-Help Credit Union, City Heights CDC, and Microsoft. So what we're going to be doing, we've had 20 families so far sign up. We were working on putting the program together after we got funded. We had our first cohort sign up, and we should have the remaining 40 families signed up within the next 2 months. We're actually actively working on that right now. And all the families will receive a Microsoft tablet and 3 years of Microsoft training free. The tablet we paid for through the Kellogg Foundation, but Microsoft donated 3 years of Microsoft training for free to all of our families. 3-year membership to the YMCA at City Heights for all family members to go to. Supportive services assistance, grade level reading assistance, access to the local libraries and special programming, healthcare services, employer tours. Every family will have a bank account with Self-Help Credit Union. All families will be enrolled in the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, and all families will attend an annual Junior Achievement Program. Yes, thank you for that. So that gives you an overview of some of the programs that we've been working on. The strategies for the future and the single parent program will actually finish in June. The 2G in San Diego will finish in June 2019. I continue to work with my team to create meaningful partnerships and with local organizations. And our focus right now is to increase the amount of training dollars that we can have for our families. We're in talks right now with Local Initiative Support Corporation, LISC, to receive funding for the next 3 years just for training services. So we should have news with that in the next month or so. And we were just awarded funding for a residential leadership academy, which we will be providing for our folks downstairs for our participants. And that was funded by the County of San Diego. Any questions?
Stephanie, great presentation. I'm always amazed by the work that you guys are doing with the Achievement Academy workshop. And I really applaud you guys for working with those NGOs that are out there that are in the space to be able to help us carry out our mission that we're doing there. Because there's folks, as you identified some here, and there's others that are in that space that we can rely on and try to leverage our efforts. My only point is that one thing that I'd highly recommend that we do is let's have impact reporting as part of this. Let's focus in on being able to determine over time what are we achieving out of this thing on a real time basis. And I mean, what the jobs, and you've identified, you've already really started that, but that's where I want to go with it, is that we really focus in on what the real impact that we are achieving, and that's going to help us with future funding sources down the road.
Absolutely.
Mr. Gentry?
Just three related remarks about the wonderful work that Azazane and Stephanie are doing down with the Achievement Academy on the first floor. The first is we had a presence down there when I got here in 08. We had about a tenth of the amount produced then that we're getting done now, with half the staff now that we had then. And as I recall, the pivotal year was 2012, and that was when we changed the focus down there. Azucena had come on board in late 2011, became head of her department in 2013, and then Stephanie came on board in 2012. And what these two women have done has just been remarkable. And I think I could not be more pleased with anything that's going on here. And what you all are doing downstairs is helping to break the cycle. Related to that, the second comment, for those of you who either saw or read about the comments of our probable new HUD secretary yesterday, Mr. Carson, one of his remarks that he's had ever since he surfaced as a potential HUD secretary was breaking the cycle of dependency and how the programs in their typical form reinforced dependency. I think he is utterly and absolutely correct. I think what he needs to do nationally is what we are already doing here, and it's the good work that we're doing with our Moving to Work program that Jeff and Sue Ketta put together so well, along with Azazane and Stephanie, and how we've changed the rules to reward people for working and to help encourage people who don't work why they should, both positive rewards and negative sanctions. And I think it's without the positive reinforcement that comes from the first floor, none of that would work. And I could not commend you to anymore. It's just been wonderful. I'll point out in closing that not only are we getting national attention for the San Diego model, but international as well. And I had the high honor of accompanying Azazane and Stephanie to Toronto, Canada, back in early November, where we made a series of presentations before a Canadian housing group, and Canada has the same issues that we have, and much of the world has, the Western world, of these kinds of programs, and that is, how do you help people without continuing to make them need the help going forward? And so these two ladies are international rock stars now, and it was nice that they took me with them. Thank you.
I'm extremely proud of the work that you guys are getting done down. You ladies are getting done down there. This is has been a special interest area for me, and I agree that when you came on board with the mindset that we've got of trying to help people, you know, stop the multi-generational, we've been making great progress, and I'm extremely in awe of the fact that you got that grant from Kellogg. That's fantastic, and we're going to have to do more of that sort of thing throughout our agency because of the fact that we have a changing environment in Washington, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we know that funding is going to become more difficult to obtain from the federal government. So being creative and going out and finding alternative sources and operating with the mindset of a for-profit operation, even though we're a non-profit organization, is going to be so key to the continued success and growth of your program and of the program as a whole. Thank you very much. Commissioner Davis?
Yes, I have a kind of a short story to share with you, and congratulations on all you're doing. It's wonderful. Just to show you how generational education really works, in my large family, I have six siblings and many, many other people in the family. Only one person, one of my sisters, had actually gone to college. And following an accident, I had to kind of redesign my life. And when I was 60, I went to college for the first time. And I ended up getting my associate's, my bachelor, and my MBA. During this time, my granddaughters both received their bachelor's degrees, and my daughters went back to college and are still in college, and they've got their associate's degrees. And the main reason, I think, was because they didn't want grandma to outdo them. So good job putting the generations together.
Anything else? Commissioner Spoon?
You know, I agree with everything everyone has said. I've been here long enough to see the growth, and it's very exciting what you're doing downstairs, and I compliment you on all of it. And on a personal note, your presentation skills are excellent. They are just excellent, and I can imagine that you are national rock stars now. So thank you for that.
Of course, their effort in Canada was made easier by the fact that those Canadians speak a fairly close representation of English. All right, thank you very much. Next, we'll go to item 107, which is the election of the chair and vice chair for the year 2017. Before we take nominations, I'm going to announce that both the current chair, myself, and the current vice chair, Commissioner Spoon, are both stepping down from the office positions. And so we're not available to accept a nomination for this next year. Saying that, I'll open the floor to nominations for the position of chair. Are there any nominations? Commissioner Spoon?
Well, first of all, I would personally like to thank you, Gary, for your leadership all of these years. You are certainly, it's been a personal pleasure to work with you on all of these projects. I think the leadership that you've shown, not only for staff and for other board members, has been priceless. Your demeanor, your ability to see clearly, your laser focus, I say that as a compliment, your laser focus, your compassion, your empathy, and also your business sense has certainly benefited not only this board but the agency. So with that, I would hope that Commissioner Urdison would accept the nomination for chair of this board. As we could see by his performance today, he will make an excellent chair. His excellent chair. I would hope that he would. It's an exciting time to be on this board, and to be in a leadership position on the board now that we have established connections both at the state level and at the city level. I think this will just be a very dynamic time to be in a leadership position in these areas. So I would like to nominate Commissioner Urdison for chair.
Okay. And before I acknowledge both the motion and the second, Commissioner Tassin, will you accept the nomination and the position if elected?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had the pleasure of serving here for the last 3 to 4 years on this commission and have gained an incredible appreciation for this organization and what it has done and it's how it's reviewed, you know, on a national, even international basis. This appreciation really it was completely unexpected. I didn't know really anything about the Housing Commission before. It would be an honor for me to serve. In terms of commitment, how long, we'll take it a year at a time, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Are there any additional nominations for the position of chair? Seeing no indication of such, it has been moved by Commissioner Spoon and seconded by Commissioner Surdy that Commissioner Tassin become at the end of this meeting, immediately at the end of this meeting, the chairman of the board for the year 2017. I'm going to call the question. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The position is filled unanimously. Thank you. Next is the position of vice chair. And is there a nomination for vice chairman? Commissioner Davis?
Yes, Gary, I'd also like to thank you, and I've learned so much from you and everyone here, and I'm going to miss you. I would like to nominate Commissioner Dottie Surdy for the vice chair, and I've seen what she has helped so much, and all her information that she gives is so important, and so I would like to nominate her for vice chair.
Is there a second? Commissioner Tassin, a second of that? Now I'll ask Commissioner Surdy, the same question I asked Mr. Urtasun. Dottie, assuming that you were elected, would you accept the position?
That means I can't go backwards,
yeah.
Right?
We have a record.
I understand. Well, good for me. I'm speechless. I am so honored to be considered for the position. I have learned a lot in my last few months of being on the board, and I know that there's a lot more to learn, and I appreciate that. I appreciate the leadership of all of you and the friendship and the loyalty, and obviously our Rick Gentry is amazing, and all of the staff people, thank you so much for your expertise and your caring, and I would be delighted to accept.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any additional nominations for the position of vice chair? Seeing no indication of such, I'll close the nominations and call the question. All in favor of electing Commissioner Surdy to be the vice chairman for the year 2017, indicate by saying aye. Opposed? Okay. The next step will be that between now and probably the February meeting, Commissioner Tassin, possibly with the assistance of Commissioner Surdy, will talk to each of the members of the commission going forward, and will make committee recommendations. And generally, those recommendations are really within the purview of the chairman in his best judgment of how this organization can go forward. With that, do we have any other items on the agenda? I think not. In that case, I'll accept a motion to adjourn the meeting. Commissioner Tassin has moved adjournment. He's wanting to speed up when he becomes the chair. And Commissioner Surdy has seconded that motion. Ditto. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? This meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.